From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the new wave of anti-Semitism and how the myths and conspiracy theories circulating today have their roots in centuries of European anti-Semitism. We talk with David Kurtzer, author of The Popes Against the Jews, The Vatican's Role in the Rise of Modern Anti-Semitism. He's a professor at Brown University. Also today, designer bugs. Viruses are now being synthetically manufactured and genetically engineered. Does this spell medical breakthrough or bioterrorism? We talk with science reporter John Cohn. He'll also report on the International AIDS Conference, which he attended. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Police in Israel say a pair of Palestinian bombers killed themselves and at least three Israelis today in an attack in Tel Aviv. At least 40 people were hurt by the blast. NPR's Peter Kenyon says the bombing is the second attack on Israeli civilians in as many days.
Israeli police say two Palestinian suicide bombers entered a working-class neighborhood in the southern end of Tel Aviv, not far from the old bus station. It's home to a lot of foreign workers from Romania and elsewhere. And they were carrying bags of explosives, according to witnesses, and then they set them off. According to the police, they weren't especially large bags, but they did considerable damage. And this bombing, of course, came just a day after the bus attack up in that West Bank settlement of Emmanuel. That one killed eight Israelis. Some of those victims were still being buried today, just before this attack occurred.
NPR's Peter Kenyon. The sheriff in Orange County, California, says a kidnapped 5-year-old girl died of asphyxiation. Samantha Runyon's body was found yesterday on the edge of a national forest about 50 miles from her home. The child was abducted in front of her apartment building on Monday by a man who lured her near his car by asking for help to find a lost puppy. Sheriff Michael Corona said Samantha was sexually assaulted. An FBI spokesman said authorities believe that the kidnapper may be a serial rapist and killer. Samantha's kidnapping came after two other high-profile disappearances of children this year, including that of 7-year-old Danielle Van Dam in San Diego and 14-year-old Elizabeth Smart in Salt Lake City. The State Department is reviewing its policies for issuing visas amid criticism that lax procedures enabled some of the September 11th hijackers to enter the United States. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
Some criticism of the State Department's policies concerns a program called Visa Express. It allows visa applications to be submitted through travel agents or other third parties. Three of the hijackers on September 11th apparently took advantage of the program. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says Visa Express simply allows third parties to facilitate the clerical work of applications.
But no visa is ever issued without the authorization of an American officer. And no visa is ever issued without a database check against all the information from the law enforcement and intelligence people.
Nonetheless, Boucher says the program is going to be altered and possibly eliminated. He says the State Department has tightened procedures significantly since September 11th and plans to make more changes as part of a worldwide review. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 69 points to close at 8,542 in very heavy trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 22 points, or 1.6%. It closed at 1,397. The S&P 500 gained 5. This is NPR News. The daughter of Florida Governor Jeb Bush was sent to jail today for failing to abide by a court-ordered drug treatment plan. The governor issued a statement saying that his 24-year-old daughter, Noelle, was sentenced to 3 days in jail in Orlando for contempt of court. Noelle Bush was arrested last January for trying to buy an anti-anxiety drug with a fake prescription. A public-private partnership has announced new standards intended to make computers safe against attack. For now, the new standards will be used to protect government computers, but it's hoped they can be applied to home computers. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Several different government agencies will begin working with settings that are designed to prevent break-ins by hackers or by terrorists. The Center for Internet Security brought together government and private companies to agree on the standards, which will be used on the Windows 2000 operating system. Richard Clark, the president's cybersecurity advisor, says the change is needed because the most common attacks can easily be stopped.
They could have been stopped if the users, if the systems administrators, had been given the information they need and the tools they need.
Government computer administrators will now have access to tools that can help them keep their systems safe from attack. The administration wants to expand this program across government and to private users, including average consumers. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
For the third year in a row, Army soldiers are being called upon to help deal with a devastating fire season. The National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho, says 650 soldiers will head to eastern Oregon next week to help contain an 18,000-acre blaze that's in danger of spreading. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new wave of anti-Semitism has spread around the world, set off by Islamic extremism and the Middle East conflict. Many people in the Muslim world believe that a Jewish conspiracy was behind September 11th. Jewish individuals, schools, and synagogues have been attacked in parts of Europe and Africa. My guest, David Kurtzer, has studied the history of anti-Semitism. He's the author of the recent book, The Popes Against the Jews, The Vatican's Role in the Rise of Modern Anti-Semitism. He's a professor of social science, anthropology, and Italian studies at Brown University. Kurtzer says that Islamic anti-Semitism is relatively new when compared to Christian anti-Semitism. In the Middle Ages, when Jews were expelled from several European countries, many of them took refuge in Islamic countries. But the strain of anti-Semitism in the Islamic world today is informed by myths that date back to medieval Europe.
If you look at what's happening recently in the Islamic world, and particularly the Arab world, you find a rise, curiously and disturbingly, of many of the anti-Semitic ideas that really grew up in Christian Europe and had been associated with Christianity, and not only in medieval times, but unfortunately right up until the Second World War. It took really the Holocaust to cure European Christianity of these anti-Semitic views.
What's an example of one of those anti-Semitic myths that is floating around the Islamic world now that has its roots in European anti-Semitism?
Well, a good example is the ritual murder myth. This holds that Jews are somehow commanded by their religion to kidnap non-Jewish children, then torture them as painfully as possible, draw out all their blood, because this blood, according to this myth, is required by Jews for various rituals, the most commonly cited one being the use of non-Jewish children's blood for matzah, for Passover. Well, this grew up in Europe, beginning in the 1100s, and can be found, unfortunately, right into the 20th century in Christian Europe, and in fact was backed by the Vatican into the early part of the 20th century. But, of course, has been totally discredited as we got into the 20th century in Christian Europe, although it was used by the Nazis to considerable effect. Today, we find in the year 2002, various government-sponsored newspapers in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia, elsewhere in the Arab world, repeating this myth and charging the Jews with taking the blood of now Islamic children as well as Christian children to use for their Jewish ritual.
Now, you mentioned that current theories circulating about the Jews, particularly among some Islamist extremists, is there's Jewish conspiracy theories that the Jews control the banks and the press. They're trying to control the world. Is this connected to the Protocols of the Elders of Zion? Is that do you find that writing is gaining currency again?
Yes, amazingly, this is being published apparently in scores of different editions in the Arab world today. Well, this is a forgery. It began in the early, or the turn of the 20th century, in Tsarist Russia, where the Tsar's secret police came up with this fanciful tale of a worldwide Jewish conspiracy aimed at taking over the world and essentially enslaving all the non-Jews of the world. It became the Bible of European anti-Semitism in the 1920s, was adopted by the Nazis, but also was published by rather respectable people in Europe and in the U.S., where Henry Ford was involved in its distribution. But, of course, even by the 1920s and 1930s, was rejected by responsible Europeans. However, today it's making a reappearance in the Arab world.
You said that you found a quote from the protocols on the website of Hamas.
Well, right in the covenant of Hamas, the founding document of Hamas, it refers to the protocols of the Elders of Zion to make its case that they have evidence that the Jews not only want Israel, but they want to take over all of the Arab world as part of their quest for world domination.
In reading your book, The Popes Against the Jews, I learned a lot about the many times over the centuries in which Jews were expelled or ghettoized in countries throughout Europe. Do you think that that connects to the wave of anti-Semitism in Europe that we're seeing now?
Well, there's a very long tradition of anti-Semitism in Europe, something that many Europeans essentially tried to deny. And it's not surprising that you would still find anti-Semitism in Europe, given its historical pedigree. For hundreds of years, Jews were persecuted. They were banned from living in Britain, in France, in large parts of Germany. Of course, is the famous case of Spain and Portugal, where they were thrown out beginning in 1492 or forced to convert. And in those areas where they were allowed to exist, for example, the Papal States in central Italy with its capital Rome under the Pope's dominion, the Jews were not allowed to live in most areas, were only allowed to live in a handful of cities which had ghettos which locked them in at night. So given, and that last ghetto, of course, was Rome, which was only liberated in 1870 when forces of Italian unification took it from the Pope. So 1870 is not that long ago, really, from a historian's perspective anyway, and the legacy remains.
Now, your latest book is called The Pope Against the Jews, The Vatican's Role in the Rise of Modern Anti-Semitism. What would you say was the most extreme period in which the Vatican played a big part in anti-Semitism?
Well, my interest particularly is the rise of modern anti-Semitism. When we talk about modern anti-Semitism, we're talking about a social, political movement with its roots beginning in the 1880s. And it then ultimately goes on through the 1930s, and one wing of it would develop as Nazism. The Vatican has denied that it played any role in the rise of modern anti-Semitism, claiming a distinction between what they call anti-Judaism, which is based on religious negative views of the Jews, like Jews as the killers of Christ, and opposing that to modern anti-Semitism, which they see as based on negative economic, political, and social characterizations of the Jews. So in the Popes Against the Jews, what I try to demonstrate is that this distinction does not hold, that is, between religious anti-Judaism of a sort that the church was involved in, and a economic, political, social anti-Semitism, which was responsible for the kind of hatred that could ultimately lead to the Holocaust. And so for me, the most interesting and most important period, really, is the period where anti-Semitism gets started in the 1880s, 1890s, and the beginning of the 20th century.
And how does anti-Semitism change its colors during that period?
Well, it begins to focus on the role of the Jews as being responsible for all the evil of modern times. You see, once when the Jews for centuries had either been banned from much of Europe or been forced to live in ghettos, not allowed to own their own houses, their own property, and so forth, this wasn't an issue. But once the Jews were emancipated, given equal rights progressively in Europe through the 19th century, something, by the way, the Vatican always opposed, now they could become the scapegoat for all the traumas associated with the transition to modern times.
So this is where the whole Jewish conspiracy theory starts to come in, of Jews being the controlling the press and running governments and conspiring to take over the world. These more almost like secular forms of anti-Semitism, where it's not about the religion per se, it's about these other plots.
Right. In fact, one of the crucial features here is that in the past, the real enemy was the religious Jew, Whereas now, the real enemy was a secular Jew. The Jew was responsible for capitalism. The Jew was charged with being responsible for communism and for socialism and for the spread of secularism, for the desire to separate church and state. All these aspects of modern times that were being denounced by the church. And this continued in one form or another well into the 20th century.
Now, how worried are you personally, as an observer of, as a scholar of anti-Semitism, how worried are you personally about the latest waves of anti-Semitism?
Well, I am concerned, not in the United States. I mean, there is some anti-Semitism in the United States, but fortunately, it's quite peripheral, and it's not something I think we need to be terribly worried about. I mean, there's some incidents, and those need to be dealt with. But in Europe, it's quite different. And of course, in the Arab world and the Muslim world more generally, it's different still. In the Arab world, the teaching of the hatred of the Jews to young children on a mass level is something that's producing a generation after generation of those whose minds essentially are being poisoned about Jews, and of course about now in many areas of anti-Americanism is associated with anti-Semitism in parts of the Arab and Muslim world. In Europe, the situation is preoccupying when you see, for example, anti-Israeli demonstrations, which quickly turn into anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish kinds of demonstrations. And even at the highest kinds of intellectual levels, of course, recently there's been this case of the editor of these academic journals in Britain who kicked the two Israeli members of the editorial board of this journal, of these two journals, off the editorial board, saying that they bear some kind of responsibility for Nazi-like behavior because of Israel's activity with respect to the Palestinians.
Do you find that it's getting difficult to draw the distinction between anti-Israeli feelings and anti-Semitic feelings? A government's policy is very controversial. You could take whatever side you want to on it, and disagreeing with a government policy is very different than vilifying a whole religion.
Now, this is true, and it's an important distinction to keep in mind, that it is easy for certain defenders of Israel to try to besmirch anybody who criticizes Israeli policy as being anti-Semitic, particularly if they're not Jewish. And this can intimidate some non-Jews into criticizing Israeli policy as they think they should. On the other hand, you also have to ask, at least Jews certainly ask this question, why is it that with all the destruction, the murders, the mass murders, the violence of governments around the world that have been going on for the last decades, unfortunately, it's Israel that has become almost a single focus of European, particularly European ire. And the boycotts are aimed at Israeli academics, for example, and not academics from other countries who might be seen as engaged in more nefarious behavior than even the worst critics of Israel would accuse it of. And so there is the suspicion that this peculiar focus on Israel, the fact apparently that there have been more, for example, United Nations resolutions aimed at criticizing Israel than at all other countries in the world combined. As a Jew, one has to ask, is there some kind of basic anti-Semitism and focus on the Jews as a source of evil that's behind this?
My guest is David Kurtzer. He's the author of the book, The Popes Against the Jews, The Vatican's Role in the Rise of Modern Anti-Semitism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Kurtzer. He's a professor at Brown University and author of the book, The Popes Against the Jews, The Vatican's Role in the Rise of Modern Antisemitism. As part of your research for this book, The Pope Against the Jews, you got access to the archive of the Central Office of the Inquisition. That archive was recently opened when you started doing research there?
That's right. And in fact, first of all, I should say the Catholic Church and the Vatican deserves tremendous credit for opening its historical archives to researchers like me. In other words, not only its own in-house kind of researchers, but to the larger scholarly world, the research for the Popes Against the Jews couldn't have been done unless the Vatican had opened its archives in this way.
I'd love to hear about some of the documents that you found from the Inquisition.
Well, one comes from the 20th century. In the very end of the 19th century, in 1899, in November, the Vatican daily newspaper, Osservatore Romano, which is still today daily newspaper of the Vatican, ran the latest in its long, decades-long series of articles on Jewish ritual murder. The actual title of the piece was Judaic Ritual Murder, charging the Jews with murdering some child to drain him of his blood. Recently, it's the latest case of many, many cases that were, they claim, taking place in Europe then. Well, the Archbishop of Westminster, who's the head of the Catholic Church for Britain, was upset to see this latest article and in the Vatican newspaper. And, of course, he's coming from a place where Catholics themselves were a persecuted minority. So he wrote to the Pope, Leo XIII, and said, you've got to do something about this. It's embarrassing to the Catholic Church. It's embarrassing to the Vatican to be associated with this kind of medieval superstition of Jewish ritual murder. So we now know that Pope Leo XIII referred the whole matter to the Central Office of the Inquisition, which is a group of cardinals chaired, actually, by the Pope himself. And we can find not only their kind of official document and what they came up with 6 months later when they reached their decision, but also the notes of the coordinator, the cardinal coordinating their work. And what we find is that these cardinals not only believed in Jewish ritual murder, now we're talking about the 20th century, and they ended up in July of 1900 telling the Pope that ritual murder had been established for centuries by the Vatican as the nefarious practice of the Jews, and therefore the petition of the Archbishop of Westminster had to be denied. But the private notes by the cardinals say clearly the Archbishop of Westminster has become a dupe of the powerful Jews of London.
What years was the Office of the Inquisition open between?
Well, the Inquisition began in the 1540s. It was not, by the way, initially aimed particularly at the Jews. The timing is significant here. It's during the Reformation, so it really became one of the first instruments of the Counter-Reformation, that is, countering the spread of the Protestant heresy, as it was seen in the Vatican, seen in Rome. And so it aimed at trying to enforce orthodoxy. The Jews became a kind of victim by the way, in that, again, the main initial object was the dealing with the Protestants.
And so when did it close?
Well, it lasted actually into the 20th century. In fact, today there is one of the congregations of the Vatican is the congregation headed by Cardinal Ratzinger to ensure orthodoxy deals with issues, for example, of excommunicating priests. And this congregation, which still is in the building of the Holy Office of the Inquisition, is the successor of the Inquisition. But by during the 20th century, the name was changed. And its mission, of course, has been changed as well. You have to realize that also there was a big difference when the Pope had control over certain territory, as he did in the Papal States, which ran from Rome up through Bologna and Ferrara in central northern Italy. The Inquisition also had police powers behind it. Well, with the end of the Papal States in 1870, with the fall of Rome, the inquisitors could no longer order the police to seize people, including seizing Jews, as they did in various circumstances. So the whole nature of the Inquisition changed then.
Your book is about the Vatican's role in the rise of anti-Semitism. What would you like to see the Catholic Church do in response to the latest waves of anti-Semitism?
Well, first of all, I'd like to see the Church come to terms with its own history and its own role in the rise of modern anti-Semitism. The current Pope, John Paul II, has, first of all, should be noted, done a great deal to increase a better understanding with other religions, including with the Jews. We remember early in his papacy, his dramatic visit to Auschwitz, also another very important visit to the synagogue of Rome, the major synagogue of Rome. Of course, more recently in the year 2000, his visit to Israel. So he's done a great deal to try to improve relations between the Catholic Church and the Jews, and he deserves credit for this. On the other hand, when these issues have come up about how his predecessors, previous popes and Vatican previously, had been involved in modern anti-Semitism, he reacted initially by referring the matter to a group of cardinals who spent 11 years deliberating, doing historical research, and coming up with a report in 1998, a report that's a very important one of the Vatican called We Remember, a reflection on the Shoah, on the Holocaust. And it's in that report that the Vatican denies that it played any role in the rise of modern anti-Semitism, clinging to this distinction of anti-Judaism, simply religious negative views of the Jews that it does admit being involved in, but saying it wasn't involved in the rise of modern anti-Semitism, which it claims was linked to anti-Catholic nationalist groups. Well, so first of all, I think the church needs to take a frank look at its past, as the Pope, in fact, has called on the church to do, because it's hard to criticize what's going on in the Muslim world until one takes responsibility for one's own involvement in very similar activities in the past. That said, it would be nice to see the Catholic Church, if we focus just on the Catholic Church for the moment, in areas where anti-Semitism has been spreading, whether in Europe or in the Muslim world, to take more aggressive action in confronting it than it has.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
David Kurtzer is the author of The Popes Against the Jews, The Vatican's Role in the Rise of Modern Antisemitism. He's a professor at Brown University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Clan of the Cave Bear and all the novels by Jean M. Hall, already available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, designer bugs, synthetically created and genetically engineered viruses. They can help us, but they can also be used against us as bioterrorist weapons. We talk with science journalist John Cohn. He'll also report on the International AIDS Conference, which he attended.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A team of scientists announced last week that they had synthesized a live polio virus. It's the first time a live virus has been constructed from scratch. The experiment was financed by the Pentagon as part of its research on combating bioterrorism. Science journalist John Cohen has an article in the current edition of The Atlantic Monthly about designer bugs, genetically engineered viruses that could help humanity or be used as biological weapons. The virus Cohen has followed most closely is HIV. He's the author of a book on the search for an AIDS vaccine called Shots in the Dark, and last week he attended the International AIDS Conference in Barcelona, which we'll talk about a little later. Let's start with a synthetically made polio virus. It may help the Pentagon protect us against biowarfare, but it could also help inform the work of bioterrorists. I asked Cohen if the Pentagon funding of this experiment is controversial.
This is coming out of the DARPA group, which funds really high-risk experimental stuff. I don't think it's hugely controversial. I think most scientists thought that you could do this. It's not such a great shock that you can do it. Polio is really small. It's easier to do this with polio than just about any other virus that might hurt humans. And if you compare it to, let's say, smallpox, polio has about 7,000 components. Smallpox has about 200,000. It's much more complex to do this with a nasty bug like smallpox, and there are lots of people who doubt that given the technology that exists today that you could do it.
Now, in the current edition of The Atlantic magazine, you have an article about a mousepox experiment. Mousepox, I guess, is kind of like smallpox, but it only affects mice, not people. What was the goal of this experiment that you write about?
Originally, Australia has a horrible problem with rabbits and other introduced species. Australia is a big island that didn't have a lot of species that now exist there. And rabbits were brought in 1859 by a sportsman, essentially. And rabbits do what rabbits do, and they soon overtook the island and created what was called a gray blanket. And ever since the late 1800s, Australians have been trying to figure out how to take care of their rabbit problem. And this experiment initially set out to stop the production of new rabbits. It was biowarfare against rabbits.
And what did the scientists create?
Well, in 1950, the Australians tried to deal with their rabbit problem by releasing a virus that had never been released there, called myxoma virus. And I have to tell you this background because it explains what they ended up doing this time around.
Mm-hmm.
The myxoma virus was put into the environment there, and the first year it killed about 99% of the rabbits. It was a terrific way to kill rabbits. But over about 3 years' time, the virus and the rabbits started to figure out how to live together, and only about 95% of the rabbits died from the release of the virus. And then as more years passed, it became about lethal to about 50% of the rabbits. So myxoma wasn't that good of a virus to attack rabbits. So the scientists in this current experiment set out in 1988 to engineer myxoma to sterilize rabbits. Rather than to kill them, they just wanted to sterilize them. And that's the genesis of this experiment.
And then they tried to do the same with mice?
Right. Well, they tried to engineer myxoma virus to carry a gene from the egg of rabbits. So the thinking was is that they would teach the rabbits to attack their own eggs. But they didn't have the right genes to work with rabbits, but they did have them for mice and mouse pox. So it was sort of a parallel system that they could test the idea in of making a sterilizing vaccine, if you will. That's what they were up to. So they took mouse pox, which is a cousin of smallpox and is highly infectious in mice, and stitched in the egg protein into that background, into that vector is what mousepox is called. It's a Trojan horse that's going to then deliver this this egg protein. And it worked, but it didn't work that well.
Well, the larger point of your article in The Atlantic is that this is good news and this is bad news at the same time. How is this designer virus good news?
Well, it's kind of the great conundrum with all these designer bugs is, in this case, if rats, for example, destroy about 20% of the world's crops, if we could better control rats, we could feed many millions of more people who are the poorest people on Earth, people who are some of the angriest people on Earth at countries that have a lot of money. So some people have argued that, look, by doing things like this, you actually reduce the likelihood of a terrorist attack by feeding more people.
And how is this bad news?
Well, the bad news is when they first started doing the experiment, they didn't have tremendous success in sterilizing mice, so they decided to introduce yet another gene to the mousepox virus. And this other gene they introduced was meant to tilt the immune system so that it would have even a stronger response against the eggs of the mice. And it surprisingly ended up killing the mice. The mousepox went into a strain of mice it usually didn't harm, and when it was engineered this way, they died. So then the scientists thought, well, let's give them the smallpox vaccine, which actually protects against mousepox because they're so closely related. And about 60% of the vaccinated mice again died. So it raised the specter that you could engineer a smallpox virus that would get around the smallpox vaccine. And that was terrifically frightening. And it is frightening that you could do such a thing because it's a great vaccine that has eradicated that virus from the earth. It's the only virus that humans have ever wiped off the face of the earth.
So with this designer mousepox, and with the synthesis of the polio virus, what are some of the possibilities we're facing in terms of bioterrorism?
Well, I try to keep a really even keel when I think through this stuff and look at what does it really mean? What are we really facing in terms of danger? On the one hand, there are a few bugs that are nastier than natural smallpox. There are a few bugs that are nastier than natural poliovirus. It's pretty hard to design something that's going to be better. And in fact, if you do design something and put it out there, the odds are you're going to end up with a situation similar to the rabbits and myxoma virus. It will find a natural way to get along with humans that probably isn't as devastating to us as what already exists. So that's the rational, positive side of all this. The other side of it is there are really nasty, evil people in the world who spend their time thinking up horrible things to do to each other. And there are more ways to hurt people now more quickly than existed in the past because of these advances. So I think the real bottom line here is we have to be aware of what the potential attacks are and defend ourselves against them ahead of time. We could potentially make a vaccine that could deal with this smallpox bug that can now get around the existing vaccine. If indeed that's even true, this is a mouse experiment. I mean, who knows once you put this into smallpox virus what it will do.
You write that the Bush administration has removed from public access thousands of federal reports about germ warfare and that the Bush administration is starting to draft a new policy on information security. What are some of the things the administration has done and what are some of the things that are under consideration now?
There have been lots of studies of germ warfare that have been published and put on the web by the government, and those have now been taken off. They've also clamped down on what they will release through the Freedom of Information Act request. I recently had a response that was filled with blank pages to a pretty innocuous question about smallpox vaccine procurement. In addition to that, the Bush administration officials in a backroom meeting met with heads from the American Society of Microbiology, which publishes 10 journals, and asked them to at least consider withholding publication of some data. And one of their journals is indeed the journal that published the mousepox story, the Journal of Virology.
My guest is science journalist John Cohen. His article on designer viruses is in the current edition of the Atlantic Monthly. He was in Barcelona at the International AIDS Conference last week. We'll talk about the conference after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Cohen. John, in this month's Atlantic Magazine, you have your story on designer viruses. And you just got back from Barcelona, where you were reporting on the AIDS conference for Science magazine. Is there a connection between AIDS and these designer viruses that may be used for good or may be used for biological warfare?
Yeah, there is. It's a strong one, too. HIV, essentially, is an emerging infectious disease that showed up in a big way in 1981 by introducing a designer bug into a population. You're effectively introducing an emerging infectious disease, very much in the way that HIV shocked people when it showed up. You could shock a population by introducing a new strange bug. Polio, by the way, showed up as a strange new bug as well in the 1890s.
Well, you just got back from Barcelona. What would you say was the general mood at the AIDS conference?
There are two worlds that exist there. One is the poor countries of the world and their needs, and the other is the rich countries. The overall thrust of the meeting was really directed at getting treatment and prevention to the poor countries of the world. The epidemic, in the words of Peter Piot, who's the head of UNAIDS, is really just beginning, and I think a lot of people have a hard time accepting that, but the new figures are astounding.
What are they?
Well, there are now 40 million HIV-infected people in the world. The projection is that by the year 2010, unless something is done in a comprehensive way, there will be 45 million new infections. I mean, it's chilling.
Yeah. What are some of the signs of optimism that you saw at the conference?
Well, there's a movement to get drugs to poor people, and it didn't exist 2 years ago. It really started 2 years ago, and the prices of drugs have plummeted. There are new drugs coming on the market for people in rich countries that will help deal with some of the severe limitations that exist to the existing drugs. There is basic research moving forward into new avenues that promise to deliver in 5 or 10 years. So there are positive things happening. Overall, though, the thrust of the meeting, the real gestalt and zeitgeist of it was the world has failed to really acknowledge what a horrible thing is happening in most of the world. 94% of the infected people in the world live in poor countries. And many people feel as though the leaders of the world are just standing by and watching.
What else struck you as being particularly important at this AIDS conference?
Well, 2 years ago in Durban, this incredible sea change occurred where people realized that the world could no longer ignore poor people, and the world had to start thinking seriously about getting drugs and prevention efforts everywhere. And a series of events happened after Durban, and something was created called the Global Fund to Treat AIDS, Malaria, and Tuberculosis. That fund now has a few billion dollars in it. The goal is to have $10 billion for HIV and AIDS alone each year, and an additional $3 billion for TB and malaria. And much of the conference focused on that fund and how to build up its coffers. A lot of criticism was directed at the United States because the world really looks to the U.S. to see how much it will contribute, and so far it has committed $500 million. Many of the people at the conference argued that it should be putting in $2.5 billion. And Tommy Thompson, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, in fact, there was a demonstration by activists there that would not allow him to speak. And he read his speech, but you couldn't hear a word of it. And much of their anger was directed at the U.S. contribution to the Global Fund, which they saw as paltry.
Is there speculation that the money would be higher were it not for the war on terrorism, as the war on terrorism seen as competing with money for AIDS prevention and treatment?
You know, I don't think so. I think that's used as a polemic by people who want more money. They argue, hey, look how much you're spending on this. Why don't you spend this much on that? The argument, and when you go to the International AIDS meeting, it's really like getting in the space shuttle and traveling to another planet. And you arrive in this place that has people from every nation with all different concerns who are watching this virus destroy the earth. I mean, that's really what's happening. And I know that sounds overly dramatic and apocalyptic, but you can't go to this planet and not see that. It's what's happening right now. So people pull out all sorts of rhetorical arguments to try to wake up the world to this reality, that this is the worst epidemic humans have faced. And people may be tired of hearing about it. They may be unconcerned because they're not connected to it. The reality is we are at the beginning of this. And so let's wake up.
Now, you mentioned that Tommy Thompson was jeered so loudly and no one could even hear his address. Former President Clinton spoke at the AIDS conference. What kind of reception did he receive?
The audience loved Bill Clinton. He was his charismatic self, and he received a standing ovation. And I had a little bit of difficulty figuring out what his role here will be. He didn't really describe it in any detail. It's the first time he's come to an international AIDS conference. And the backroom discussions in the press room and the journalists, was, many of us were very confused because he elected not to speak with us. He did decide to speak with a small group of reporters from powerful publications together, but they didn't issue a pool report. There was no way for us to really know what happened. And for many of us who have covered this for a long time, it was a sort of a bizarre experience to have him show up and then not really address our questions, as most every other world leader does, about what they hope to contribute, where they fit in.
Did Nelson Mandela meet with the press?
Nelson Mandela did not, but he remains extremely accessible to the press, so it wasn't as much of an issue. It's not hard for journalists to reach Nelson Mandela. Traditionally, he goes for walks every day, and people can join him for his walks. And I think there was a clearer sense of what Nelson Mandela's role here is. Nelson Mandela spoke at the last conference in Durban, and it was one of the most powerful speeches I've ever seen anyone make. The whole room started singing his name and swaying, and it went on for minutes, and I think anyone who was there will never forget that. His symbolism is so very clear in a country that has 20% of the adults infected. And his leadership in the face of Thabo Mbeki, the president of South Africa, who has questioned whether HIV even causes AIDS, needed no extra comment. But with Clinton, who's a newcomer to the arena here, I think there are a lot of questions about where he fits in.
Mm-hmm. You're the author of a book about the search for an AIDS vaccine. Are we any closer to a vaccine? Any new information about that came out of the conference?
Nothing new came out at the conference that made me think we're any closer. There are more players involved now with deeper pockets than ever before. There's some positive momentum with a few big pharmaceuticals really trying to help solve the problem. The basic research news that came out of the conference regarding vaccines was very sobering and depressing and made the goal seem a little further away.
What was that?
Then again, well, one of the things that is curious about HIV is it's difficult to find people who become infected who can become infected again with another strain of HIV. That gives people hope that, hey, the immune system can learn to defeat the virus. But at the conference, there were three very solid examples of people who became infected with a second strain. It's called superinfection. And in one person, the researcher who made this presentation showed that the person had a terrifically strong immune response to his first virus and still could not defeat the second one. And that takes the shine off at least that immune component as being the way to go. Now, nothing's that simplistic. It's a system. There are all these components that fight the virus in the immunologic response. But there are always stars that rise to the top and become the favorites of the field. And this particularly study really did take the shine off this one particular star, the star du jour.
So if the body can come down with one AIDS virus and not be immune to a different strain of the AIDS virus, that makes it more difficult for a vaccine to succeed against all viruses, AIDS viruses?
It does. It does, yeah. And there are lots of different strains of the virus circulating in the world. So the simplest thing would be a vaccine that protected you from the very strain you have. That would be the easiest thing to train the immune system to do. But what you need in the real world is a vaccine that protects you from absolutely anything you come across. And that's the dream. And this conference made it seem like a little bit more distant of a dream. The flip side of the coin is there are vaccines in human trials. One of them is in a full-blown efficacy trial, and we'll have information later this year as to whether it works. It might. Lots of people in the scientific community doubt it. I think the majority would say they have very low hopes that it will work. But who knows? You have to do the experiment.
My guest is science journalist John Cohen. He's a correspondent for Science Magazine and has an article in the current edition of The Atlantic. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is science journalist John Cohen. He's been following the AIDS epidemic for years. He's the author of a book on the search for a vaccine called Shots in the Dark. Last week, he was at the International AIDS Conference in Barcelona. Are any of the new AIDS drugs running into problems of drug resistance?
Basically, all drugs that aim to stop viruses or bacteria run into problems of drug resistance. With HIV, it happens more quickly because the virus accumulates mutations so quickly, and it replicates at such a rapid rate. So yes, basically every drug that exists is facing drug resistance problems, and there also is increasing evidence of people transmitting drug-resistant viruses to each other. A study that came out at the end of last year showed that 78% of people had some drug-resistant virus in their bodies. I mean, that's a staggering number of people. You can have some drug-resistant virus in you and still respond to other drugs, but over time you're going to accrue more and more resistance. That's the natural way of things. It's not going to go in the other direction.
Do you mean, was that a reference to 78% of the people with AIDS have some kind of resistant drug? Or
78% of the people with HIV infection
right, okay.
In this study, in this very large study, had evidence of drug-resistant virus in their body, of at least resistance to one drug. There are now 16 drugs that have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration in the United States. So you have a big quiver to choose from. But people are running out. And people are still dying from AIDS who are receiving the latest treatments. So some of that is certainly due to drug resistance.
The Global AIDS Fund is building a collection of money to be used for the prevention and the treatment of AIDS. But what are some of the issues behind how to actually use this money?
It's a dizzying question, and I think it was probably, in the conference, that was probably the most confusing question of all. Where does the Global Fund fit in with other efforts? And then how should countries receive the money? Countries have to ask the Global Fund for money and have to lay out their plans of how they would spend that money. This is all just getting off the ground, and there are some people who are now calling for a military-like operation that has a master plan of how to go about stopping the virus on the globe as though we were one people. Let's pretend for a moment that we are all in this together. How should we best go about spending money, how much is really needed, how much should each country devote to this based on gross national product or some other formula? All these questions are defy easy answers, and they are ultimately what will decide who gets drugs when. And right now in sub-Saharan Africa, which has about 70% of the infections in the world, about 36,000 people are estimated to be receiving treatment. I mean, it's trivial. There are 6 million people in the world who need treatment now by the estimations of UNAIDS, and about 2% of them receive treatment. We're failing. I mean, you can't slice it any other way. It's a failure of the world. I mean, this virus takes apart societies. You have to see, I guess, firsthand what happens in countries that have 20 or 30% of the adults infected to just watch countries crumble.
Which hard hit?
There will be countries I think that may not exist in 5 or 10 years because of HIV. They may actually implode.
Which countries are you thinking of?
Well, Botswana has 39% of the adults infected. 39%. I mean, think about it. It's, you know, more than one in three. What happens to a country that has that much devastation? Now, maybe treatments will come in and prolong life enough in Botswana to make a big difference, but that's going to take a giant effort. And Botswana isn't alone. It has the highest prevalence of the virus, but there are other countries that once you get up, you know, into the range of 15-20%, I mean, just take a moment and look around wherever you're sitting and count the people in the room and imagine a fifth of them gone within 10 years who are 15, 25, 30 years old. I've been to a lot of very hard-hit countries, and you know, frankly, I get very depressed by it, and it takes me a long time when I come home to sort of readjust myself.
Right.
And you know, I'm not an activist, I'm a journalist, but you can't go into situations like this and not feel it. You'd have to have a heart of steel not to.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Terry.
John Cohn is a correspondent for Science Magazine. He has an article in the current edition of The Atlantic Monthly, and he's the author of a book about the search for an AIDS vaccine called Shots in the Dark. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Steve Erlanger, Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times, talks about European reaction to the Bush administration, its planned invasion of Iraq, its position on the Middle East, and its response to September 11th. And we'll hear how the European Union is changing the lives of Europeans. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.